million views online. Let's take a quick look at the exchange.
He's a phenomenal in what he's doing, but I don't like when people, when they have some kind of status and they go in and they do politics at the same time. Stay out of it. Just do what you're best at, because it doesn't look good.
At the end of the day, you know, I would never shut up about things that's wrong. I preach about my people, and I preach about you know, equality, social injustice, racism. It's funny he say that, because I believe in like 2018 he was the same guy who said when he was back in Sweden talking about the same things, because his last name wasn't a certain last name, that he felt like it was some racism going on. I speak from a very educated mind, I'm kind of the wrong guy to actually go at, because I do my homework.
I watched this play out online, and the public reaction was largely in favor of LeBron here, but there was still the kind of shut up and dribble team who think sports people should have nothing to say outside of their very limited and successful arena.
That's correct, Amina. Let's not forget when Muhammad Ali, when Tommy Smith, when people like Colin Kaepernick also made their protests against the same issues in the US, there were also chimes to be quiet, sit down and stay in your lane. I'm not saying necessarily that Ibrahimovic was designing his words to have that impact, but they certainly fall into that kind of tradition, if you like. And I think a lot of people are also really bewildered by the words of Zlatan Ibrahimovic, because to say people shouldn't speak about politics is in itself a decidedly political statement, really. And actually, you know, I think a lot of people recognize, were it not for people with their platforms speaking up on these issues, the world would look very different indeed. And frankly, millions more people really wouldn't be having the same conversations about the issues LeBron James has been championing. So there's a mixed reaction online. Let me go first to one tweet from Drew, who says, "What I find interesting about this is the irony. Zlatan is stepping out of his way to tell LeBron not to speak on politics. Did Zlatan major in public relations, or is he speaking on something he's not great at?" And we have a reaction from RM, who says, "I was never a LeBron fan, but the last few years he has won my respect, and not even from a basketball perspective, but this." But as you say, I mean, not everyone's in agreement. Mush tweeted, "I honestly think that LeBron is so arrogant. Zlatan is always right." So a mixture of views online, Amina, but most of them seem to be quite appreciative of what LeBron James has been doing, particularly over the last summer.
And don't forget that for many sports personalities or personalities who speak out on human rights issue, full stop, it sometimes comes with a financial cost. So it's never just done without one eye on the bottom line, and I think it should be applauded if somebody feels maybe an endorsement or two could go by the wayside, because, you know, brands don't always like to get into politics either, so Zlatan knows a little bit about that one. But we go from this feud between sports personalities to something that is very, very dear to me. The 40th anniversary of Bobby Sands, the revolutionary, the Republican revolutionary in the island of Ireland, beginning his hunger campaign. Give us a little bit more of a perspective on that story, Richard.
So Bobby Sands actually began his hunger strike 40 years ago to the day, and Bobby Sands was one of a group of 10 Irish hunger strikers who were drawing attention to the brutal conditions of Irish people essentially occupied by the British military in their own country, but they were also protesting against the removal of the special category status, and they were really demanding to be recognized not merely as prisoners but as political prisoners and prisoners of war. And, you know, at the time, the British government was doing everything it could to really silence these kinds of voices, like the voice of Bobby Sands. But actually, I think the UK government really massively underestimated the impact that the sacrifice and bravery of Bobby Sands and his comrades would really have. Because actually, the effect of the British government not really conceding to their demands actually galvanized the cause of Irish freedom, and actually it drew massive levels of support to them in Ireland beyond what was already existing, but it also put their plight firmly on the world stage. And so, you know, ultimately the sacrifice of Bobby Sands, who died after 66 days, has a lasting effect to this very day. And of course, Amina, a lot of people really kind of make a parallel between what they would say the martyrdom of Bobby Sands and, say, for example, the Palestinian hunger strikers also protesting for fair treatment as an occupied people within their own country. And for that reason, this is the reason we're talking about the first day that Bobby Sands began his hunger strike, this day 40 years ago, Amina.
Online reaction.
Let's go first to a tweet from AJ Witt, who says, I noticed Bobby Sands is trending. I remember getting a right battering at school for supporting him. The fact he was anti-Thatcher was enough for me. I admit I knew very little about republicanism or indeed the troubles back then as an English kid in England with no Irish heritage. Joshua says, it will soon be 40 years since Bobby Sands died during his hunger strike against the UK government. This should be a reminder of the incredible cruelty of UK governments, past and present, particularly the Thatcher government. And just a reminder, Amina, not everyone online is in agreement. Stella tweeted, now I may be wrong, but what's the difference between glorifying Bobby Sands and glorifying Osama bin Laden? Both murderers, I'm pretty sure Twitter would remove any post praising bin Laden.
Right, just goes to show so much more work still needs to be done. All right, Rich, we'll leave it right there, and we will leave you right there for this evening. In any case, stay safe.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Wajahidu fil lahi haq.
And
أَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِاللَّهِ هُوَ مَوْلَاكُمْ فَنِعْمَ الْمَوْلَى وَنِعْمَ
And strive for Allah with the striving due to Him. He has chosen you and has not placed upon you in the religion any difficulty. It is the religion of your father, Abraham. Allah named you Muslims before in former scriptures, and in this revelation that the Messenger may be a witness over you, and you may be witnesses over the people. So establish prayer and give zakah and hold fast to Allah. He is your protector, and excellent is the protector, and excellent is the helper.
Dear brothers and sisters, this will be the last program in which we will talk about the chapter Hajj. We have talked about 78 verses, and now we're going to talk about the remaining points regarding the last verse. وَجَاهِدُوا فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادِهِ وَاجْتَبَاكُمْ Strive hard in the way of Allah, as you ought to strive for Him. He has chosen you. وَمَا جَعَلَ عَلَيْكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ مِنْ حَرَجٍ He has not laid upon you any hardships in religion. مِلَّةَ أَبِيكُمْ إِبْرَاهِيمَ The faith of your father, Abraham. وَسَمَّاكُمُ الْمُسْلِمِينَ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَفِي هَذَا He named you Muslims, both before and in this book. لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِيدًا عَلَيْكُمْ That the messenger may be a witness over you, وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ And that you may be witnesses over the people. فَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَاعْتَصِمُوا بِاللَّهِ Therefore, establish prayer, pay the poor rate, and hold fast to Allah. وَمَوْلَاكُمْ فَنِعْمَ الْمَوْلَى وَنِعْمَ النَّصِيرُ He is your guardian, how excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper. Previously, we talked about the holy struggle and the different traditions regarding that. With regard to witnesses and being witnesses for other nations, a tradition narrated from Ali ibn Musa Rida alayhi salam indicates that he said, We are Allah's authorities among His servants, and we are the witnesses of Allah and His signs among people. So, the addressee in this Quranic phrase where it says لِيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ شَهِدًا عَلَيْكُمْ وَتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءً عَلَى النَّاسِ is apparently the whole ummah. But indeed, they are some of the chiefs and nobles of them. Addressing the whole for a part of them is very common in daily applications. For example, we recite in Surah Al-Ma'idah, the 20th verse, that Allah counting His blessings upon the children of Israel, addresses them and made you kings. So we know that only a few of them were bestowed on this rank. But the Almighty Allah is addressing the whole for a part of them. With regard to the Arabic term shuhud, we have also say that it has another meaning, which is a practical witness. And in this case, all the true believing Muslims are of this kind because they are an example ummah or a model somehow with the best religion Islam who can be a measure, an example for measuring the personality and virtue among all nations.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. A tradition from the Holy Prophet ﷺ indicates that Allah has bestowed several virtues and superiorities on the Ummah of Islam, and one of them is that in each of the former nations, their Prophet was a witness over his own people. But in Islam, he has appointed all the Ummah as a witness over people. The verse says, and you may be a witness over other people. So this means that the Prophet ﷺ is an example for his own Ummah. You are also examples for the people of the world. And of course, this does not somehow contradict the former interpretations. It is also possible that all Ummah are witnesses and the Immaculate Imams are some model and outstanding witnesses. And at the end of the verse, again, the five former duties as an emphasis are reiterated in three concise expressive sentences. It implies, now that the case is as such, you have these privileges and honors, and you should keep up prayer and give alms to the Jew people and hold fast the religion of truth under the grace of Allah, because He is your master, He is your guardian, and He is the one who secures you. The verse says, therefore establish prayer, pay the poor rate, and hold fast to Allah. And after that says, Huwa Mawlakum, He is your guardian. And when it comes to say how excellent the guardian and how excellent the helper, it is somehow a reason on the Quranic sentence which it says, and hold fast to Allah. That is, you have been commanded by the Almighty Allah, and this is for the sake that He is the supreme and the best guardian. He is the worthiest helper. In this case, there is a tradition narrated from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, who said, in all your affairs, hold fast to Allah. It is in this case that you can protect yourself by Him, the pure, through the strong power. Thank you for staying with us throughout all these programs regarding Chapter Hajj, dear listeners. I took great help and benefit from the enlightening commentary into the light of the Holy Quran available at al-islam.org. Written by Sayyid Kamal Faqih Imani. We ask the Almighty Allah to give us success and felicity and to grant us this honor to establish our prayers, to pay the poor rate, and to give us the holy struggle and holding fast blessings. Thank you for staying with us again. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear listeners, wherever you are, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Canon Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer the questions with regard to theology or whatever goes towards religion and the beliefs of people, specifically the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, in order to discuss these issues with scholars from seminary schools. We have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to this session. I'd like to welcome Sheikh to the show and say salam to him.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. Today's question that we want to ask it from the guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, is about the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. When he asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala just to assure me, show me something, to get assured, what does it mean? Does it mean that the Prophet of God was not certain of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was saying? Does it nullify his infallibility, or how can we actually collect it and digest it with the concept that an infallible entity never doubts on the power or existence of God? So, Sheikh, what is the reason that the Prophet that Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam says liyatma'inna qalbi, just to get assured, show me? Wasn't he certain of what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said so far?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Let me read the verse which talks about this event, that is the verse 260 of chapter Baqarah. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى. And when Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam said, my Lord, show me how you revive the dead. قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنُ. Allah said, do you not believe? قال بلى ولكن ليطمئن قلبي. He said yes indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. قال فخذ أربعة من الطير. Allah سبحانه وتعالى said take four of the birds. فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا. Then cut them into pieces and place a part of them on every mountain. ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا. Then call them, they will come to you hastening. واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم. And know that Allah is Almighty and All Wise. So some people, as you mentioned, they say that a prophet like Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, how come he does not believe in the day of judgment and resurrection and asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to see how Allah is going to revive the dead? And he says that I'm asking for my heart to rest at peace. A great prophet like Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, who is one of the five Ulul Azm prophets, he should have that kind of certainty in his heart. Mm-hmm. Now we need to discuss various dimensions which are related to this event. Now the first point is that, first of all, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was sure about resurrection and the day of judgment. I'm refer to some reasons to prove that Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam did not have any doubt regarding the principle of resurrection and the day of judgment. He was sure about that. The first reason is that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is asking him that awalam tu'min, do you not believe, he says that of course I believe, bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi. So very explicitly Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam mentions that I do believe in the day of judgment and resurrection. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that when Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam is talking to the idol worshippers, he refers to his belief, his firm belief in the day of judgment. For example, in chapter Ash-Shu'ara verses 81 and 82, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam talks about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and says, وَالَّذِي يُمِيتُنِي ثُمَّ يُحْيِيمُ. Allah is the one who caused me to die and then he revives me. وَالَّذِي أَتْمَعُ أَن يَغْفِرَ لِي خَطِيئَةِ يَوْمَ الدِّينِ. And I hope that God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, will forgive me يَوْمَ الدِّينِ, on the day of judgment. And also he said that رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لِي وَلِوَالِدَيَّ وَلِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ يَوْمَ يَقُومُ الْحِسَابُ. Oh Allah, on the day of judgment, forgive me, my parents, and all the believers. This is another reason which tells us that Ibrahim alayhi salam for sure did believe in the day of judgment. Mm-hmm. And there are many narrations in this regard as well. For example, it was asked from Imam al-Rida alayhi salam that أَكَانَ فِي قَلْبِهِ شَكْ. Was there any doubt in the heart of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam regarding the day of judgment and resurrection? قال الله. He said no. ولكن أراد من الله الزيادة في يقينه. He wanted a kind of increase in his certainty, which inshallah I'm going to explain.
True.
And the next reason that proves that Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam did believe in the day of judgment is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells him that take four birds and make them into pieces and do the following. But finally, Ibrahim is asked to call the birds. So if Ibrahim alayhi salam had any doubt about the resurrection, it could be done by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Allah could say that look at these four birds, I'm going to revive them. And Ibrahim alayhi salam, I mean, only needed to see. But here we see that it is done by Ibrahim alayhi salam, not by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If Ibrahim alayhi salam had any doubt about the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for resurrecting and reviving the dead, it was not necessary for him to do that and to call those birds. It was enough for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to do that and to show his power. So all these reasons tell us that Ibrahim alayhi salam for sure did believe in the Day of Judgment and Resurrection. So why he is asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to show him? There are different answers by Muslims and especially the Shia scholars.
Yeah.
The first answer is that in this verse, what Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam is asking is kayfa tuhyi al-mauta, not kayfa tahyi al-mauta. Kayfa tahyi al-mauta is how the dead people are going to be revived, which means that I'm not sure about the resurrection. This is not the case. He says kayfa tuhyi al-mauta, how you, O Allah, are going to revive the dead, which means that I do believe in the Day of Judgment, but I want to see the howness. The question is about kayfa, the howness of the deed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the deed in and of itself. So there is no doubt in the heart of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam regarding the very fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is able to revive the dead people. The only question that he has is that he needs to know about kayfiyya, the howness, the quality of this phenomenon and procedure on the Day of Judgment. So this is the explanation which mentioned by some of the Shia scholars. I think especially Allama Tabatabai and Ayatollah Javadi Amali, one of the contemporary Shia scholars. The next point is that when Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam says liyatma'inna qalbi, he is referring to different levels of certainty. We know that, for example, we have ilmul yaqin, we have aynul yaqin, and then we have haqqul yaqin. There are different levels of certainty. So, according to some scholars, what Ibrahim alayhi salam is looking for is a kind of increase in certainty about kayfiyya, about the quality. So already he knows about that by rational arguments, but now he wants to see. You know, the example is that when you see a smoke from, a far place, ilmul yaqin means that through the smoke you come to this conclusion that there is a kind of fire in that place. This is ilmul yaqin. Aynul yaqin means that no, you not only you know that, you witness that. You go to that place and you see that there is a kind of fire. This is aynul yaqin. But haqqul yaqin is that you touch the fire with your hand and you feel that this is fire. This is haqqul yaqin, the reality of the certainty. So the second explanation of the scholars is that what Ibrahim alayhi salam is looking for is that he already has the knowledge of the certainty, he has aynul yaqin, but now he wants to see that reality as well. And again, that reality is about the kayfiyya, about the quality of reviving the dead people. So already through the intellectual reasonings, he knows that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is able. But when he's able to see, then the level of his certainty increases from ilmul yaqeen and aynul yaqeen and comes to haqqul yaqeen. The next point, which is mentioned by some of the scholars, is that they refer to the occasion of the revelation. According to some narrations, Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam saw a corpse of a dead animal, and it was eaten by different animals and birds. And they say that this question came to the mind of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, that a corpse is eaten by other animals and birds. So how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to put together the body parts of this animal or human beings, which is eaten by other animals? This is famous as the shubha or the doubt of akil and ma'kul, which means that, for example, imagine a human being is dead, and then his body parts, his corpse, is eaten by other animals or even by other human beings. and it becomes a part of their flesh and body.
Yes.
So on the day of judgment, how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to create two human beings? A part of them is shared by two people, the one who was dead and the one who ate from the corpse. This is famous as the doubt of Akil and Ma'kul, and there are different answers to that.
Mm-hmm.
So these scholars believe that what Ibrahim alayhi salam asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is about this doubt especially, not about the resurrection. In and of itself, he wanted to know that how, when a human being is eaten by other animals or human beings, then what is the way for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to create that human being again? Because
but Sheikh, what is understood from the surface of the verse of the Holy Quran, this shubha cannot be taken, at least at the first look. Whatever it can be actually taken is that he does not have that certainty on the concept. At least the wording shows that. Am I right?
I'm referring to different answers. For myself, the first answer is the best one, the fact that Ibrahim alayhi salam is asking about kayfiyah,
mm-hmm.
and the howness and the quality, and not the very act of resurrection. He's sure about that. I'm just trying to mention some other possibilities mentioned by various Sunni and Shia scholars.
Mm-hmm.
They refer to the occasion of the revelation. There is a narration about that. Referring to that occasion of the revelation, I mean the story beyond the question of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, they have proposed that the doubt of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam was about the doubt of Akil and Ma'kul,
mm-hmm.
and it was his question.
So
at least there is a possibility, and
very true. Since the interpretation of Quran should be taken from the speaking Qurans, Quran and Natiq, so definitely we refer to the words of Ahlul Bayt and the Imams and the Holy Prophet to understand what the reality of interpretation of these verses of the Holy Quran are. So based on the interpretation, what the respected guest speaker said is definitely true, and we inshallah we take this aspect of it to understand this verse of the Holy Quran. Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters, for listening to Q&A on Islamic Beliefs from IR English Radio. I live in Allah's protection till our next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11816. produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president. Though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this. Did you vote today?
I voted early.
You did?
Friday.
Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in over 30 years.
Morning, gentlemen. I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, the future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors, say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock, so call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? Not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
हम रहते हैं इस कंट्री में कमा के हम खाना खाते हैं पीछे अपने फैमिली की टेक केयर करते हैं तो आई प्रे अमेरिका लिव लॉन्ग एंड प्रॉस्पर.
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too close to call scenario where the Trump wins.
Now, who we had as president, African Americans were still the lowest man on the totem pole. See to
shine. There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power. From sea to shining sea.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, a sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need. And what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about, and the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And, of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome. But many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want to Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other ways, for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
And the dramatic irony of it actually is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Deutschman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think,
Anna? Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different... Because, of course, it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, he sort of curated this. And there were
and
these other directors.
And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented. And obviously a lot of them probably had connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate and, of course, has become now a very extraordinary president because he was absolutely not the normal run-of-the-mill politician, basically. He was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected Hillary Clinton would win, and I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote. How are you feeling about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are voting for any particular candidate, we are voting for the system. And it is a system that I just don't abide by. We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually, like, care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like, my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, you're African-American?
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote, you know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room, a game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. The game was already in motion. Property was already bought. Hotels already built. And African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. That's a game you cannot win. It's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the U.S. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton, and they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator count scandal and the three strikes you're out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary exposed
the divided
nation? Well, I think
it really stressed the diversity, rather than the division, the diversity of the American population. People have been there for generations. Some are very new immigrants. It's interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who is clearly from a Punjabi family who probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people very clearly in the film felt disenfranchised even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. So I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with a EU referendum of which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of political news to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course, we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump, so it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening. I'm glad we got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election results. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
It was fascinating, wasn't it, that they felt that they kind of knew, I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario from watching it. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear. And also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen, on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions and how we become, you know, even in social media, we only really need to follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that's a springboard for thinking about that.
Definitely, and it raises many questions, actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think, actually, the social media played on the election?
Well, they have two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media, it's clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter because there, the Trumpers, if we can call them that, were really in the ascendant. And this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media had a huge impact. And Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, and whereas many people may say that a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect, and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news, because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label the news, certain news channels fake news, and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. It could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one of the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump and he's really gung-ho. And to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know?
I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
If she's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was kind of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting in what they don't personally actually really believe in. They're being swayed.
Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that which are really important. You know, there's tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. You know, one of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely that's a good thing.
Of course, but the Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. But very interesting point made by a number of people during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
About 2.9% more.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels, actually, between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow the American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though, the Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually, indeed, also, that we can compare. And I suppose UK politics seems to be a bit more on the serious side, or perhaps not.
Well, it'd be very interesting. The next election, presumably, we will have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party into an election campaign, and there'll be a big focus on, is this a man who can be Prime Minister? Is this a man who can lead Labour Party to victory? Because the opinion polls at the moment are saying more or less Conservatives and Labour equal pegging, which is bizarre when the government is doing things which are frankly difficult to support. Why isn't the opposition miles ahead? So there's a ground for a real mystery there. So perhaps some documentary maker could already be plotting the election coverage documentary of Election Day whenever it's going to be.
Perhaps. And just going back to the documentary, as we near the end of this discussion now, actually, I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting, and I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film, would you recommend it?
When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes, am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.